Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Friday the 18th of October, these are our main stories. A five-day ceasefire deal has been struck in Turkey. We hear from the region. Britain's Boris Johnson has begun an intensive campaign to persuade MPs at Westminster to approve the Brexit deal he agreed with the European Union. Tributes to the US Democratic Party Congressman Elijah Cummings, who's died at the age of 68. Also in this podcast,
it's really our last chance to ever hear from someone who was a guard at a concentration camp.
Germany holds what could be one of the last trials of a Nazi war criminal in Hamburg. After a week of violent clashes in northern Syria and a long day of negotiations in the Turkish capital Ankara, the US has now announced that Turkey has agreed to a temporary ceasefire. Here's Vice President Mike Pence.
Today, I'm proud to report, thanks to the strong leadership of President Donald Trump and the strong relationship between President Erdogan and Turkey and the United States of America, that today the United States and Turkey have agreed to a ceasefire in Syria. The Turkish side will pause Operation Peace Spring in order to allow for the withdrawal of YPG forces from the safe zone for 120 hours.
Well, Mr. Pence was speaking after meeting the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The Turkish president had previously said nothing anyone said could have stopped his offensive against Kurdish forces. President Trump hailed the development as proof that his tactics had been successful.
This is an amazing outcome. This is an outcome, regardless of how the press would like to damp it down. This was something that they've been trying to get for 10 years. You would have lost millions and millions of lives. They couldn't get it without a little rough love, as I called it. I just put out. They needed a little bit of that at the beginning. And then everybody said, wow, this is tougher than we thought.
I asked our correspondent, Barbara Pletasha, at the Turkish-Syrian border to tell us more about this agreement.
What we know from the press conference is that there will be 5 days pause in the operation to allow the Kurdish forces to withdraw from a territory along the border about 30 kilometers deep. That will be facilitated by the U.S., during which time the Turks will hold back their military operations. And if that full withdrawal is completed, then they will announce the end of their military operation. Presumably that means that they will pull back their military forces, but that I don't think was entirely spelled out. And the question was, would the YPG, the Kurdish fighters, agree to this? Mr. Pence said that they had given reassurances from the Kurds that they would do it and that the U.S. had used all the leverage that it had from years of working closely with the Kurds together to try to convince them to do this. So that's the sort of basic outline of what was agreed. And he also said, Mr. Pence, that Mr. Trump had said there would be massive sanctions if some sort of ceasefire was not agreed. And given the ceasefire announced, they would hold off, the Americans would hold off from any further sanctions, and once it was fully implemented, they would lift the ones that Mr. Trump instituted a couple of days ago.
Barbara, I've seen one Turkish official quoted saying that Turkey got everything that we wanted out of this meeting. It seems that way, on the surface anyway.
Well, they certainly wanted a buffer zone on the border. They wanted to push the Kurdish forces away from their border. So that is what is happening, yes. The question, I think, is going to be who ultimately controls that area. Will it be the Turks? Will it be the Syrian government? Would the Turks be happy with that? So that's something to work out, and they have been discussing that with the Russians who back the Syrian regime. So there are more details to be determined. But yes, they have wanted this border strip buffer zone for a long time. They've insisted on it. And from what we have heard in the press conference, it sounds as if they got it. Now, what will happen in the border zone is another question, because another thing that President Erdogan talked about was moving 2 million of the refugees that are currently in Turkey into this area, that there might be population displacement that the Kurds who are living in that area, the Kurdish civilians, without the protection of their fighting forces, might be forced out and replaced with Arabs. I believe that there was a mention in the press conference that ethnic communities would be respected. So I don't have more details on that yet, but it sounds as if that was raised in the discussions.
That was Barbara Plett-Usher. More than 3 years after Britain voted to leave the European Union, the first part of the puzzle is once again in place. A new deal has been agreed between the EU and the United Kingdom. Here's the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson.
I agree about protecting the peace process in the island of Ireland, and it means that the UK leaves whole and entire on October the 31st, and it means that Northern Ireland and every other part of the UK can take part not just in free trade deals, offering our tariffs, exporting our goods, but it also means that we can take together as a single, a united kingdom, decisions about our future, about our laws, our borders, our money, and how we want to run the UK.
The modified withdrawal agreement came after a night of intense negotiations. There's going to be a special sitting of the House of Commons on Saturday for MPs to consider the deal. Crucially, Northern Ireland's main Protestant party, the Democratic Unionists, or DUP, which had been supporting the Conservative minority government, says it cannot vote for it. More on that in a moment, but first let's look at the details of this renegotiated deal. Here's Chris Morris.
Both sides have made concessions to reach this agreement, but perhaps the biggest single concession has come from Boris Johnson, accepting the EU position that there can be no border checks anywhere on the island of Ireland. That means whatever language is used to describe it, there will be a de facto border for both customs and regulatory checks within the UK, between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. That's something that Mr. Johnson has said in the past would be unacceptable. Here's what he told the Democratic Unionist Party conference in November 2018.
We would be damaging the fabric of the Union with regulatory checks and even customs controls between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, on top of those extra regulatory checks down the Irish Sea that are already envisaged in the withdrawal agreement. Now, I have to tell you, no British Conservative government could or should sign up to any such arrangement.
But there is a compromise. Even though the de facto border would be down the Irish Sea, with Northern Ireland following EU rules on customs and tariffs under the auspices of the European Court of Justice, the legal border would remain the land border in Ireland. In other words, Northern Ireland would officially leave the EU customs union with the rest of the UK, allowing the whole country to take part in any future trade deals negotiated around the world. That is an important point of principle for the Prime Minister, but it sets up a complex dual customs system with which business will have to come to terms. If a bit of machinery was exported from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, the EU tariff on it would have to be paid. If that widget never left Northern Ireland, whoever paid the tariff could apply for a rebate. But if said widget was subsequently put into a larger piece of machinery that was exported to the Republic of Ireland, then the rebate would not apply. So it's complicated, and it does set Northern Ireland apart.
It is complicated, and the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been urging MPs to approve the deal. But what if they reject it, as they did Theresa May's proposals? At the moment, Brexit is still set for October the 31st. Here's what Jean-Claude Juncker, the President of the European Commission, had to say on whether there would be any further extension.
There will be no other prorogation.
So you're actually going to say officially that you will rule out an extension?
Yes.
To Article
50. We have a deal, so why should we have a prorogation?
But what if Parliament, UK Parliament votes against
it? I am not in charge of Westminster.
Our correspondent Rob Watson told me about the challenges Boris Johnson will face at Westminster.
He has that major problem, the one that you mentioned, of the Democratic Unionist Party, the Protestant Party, the pro-union party in Northern Ireland. And there's the reason he has the problem, and that is, put crudely, the price of Mr. Johnson's hard Brexit is Northern Ireland. I mean, that's why they're cross. I mean, essentially, Mr. Johnson has made extraordinary concessions to the European Union. One, in fact, that Theresa May had ruled out doing a couple of years ago, to say that basically Northern Ireland is going to be treated somewhat differently to the rest of the UK. Now, that is a problem because Mr. Johnson has a minority government. It also has a knock-on problem in the sense that many Conservative MPs had said in the past, maybe they'll change their mind, well, wait a minute there, if the DUP aren't on board, we might have a problem.
So, looking ahead to Saturday, it could be just a vote on this deal. It could be various other options as well, couldn't it?
It could be various other options. It could be whether to attach a second referendum to any deal. It could be having a vote on whether Britain should leave without a deal. And it would be wrong of me to duck the question that I'm sure is on everybody's lips, including yours, Nick, which is what is going to happen on Saturday? Is the deal going to get defeated? So, all I can say is that it looks like being immensely close, that the BBC has crunched the numbers based on what MPs have told us and other journalistic organisations. And I think the last time I looked, it was 317 votes for the government and 322 against.
That was Rob Watson. Let's go to the United States now, because tributes have been paid to the US Democratic Party Congressman Elijah Cummings, who's died in Baltimore, aged 68. Chris Buckler reports from Washington.
A descendant of slaves, Elijah Cummings was seen as a powerful voice who pushed for social change. As chair of the House Oversight Committee, he used his position to challenge officials on issues like healthcare and immigration, raising the ire of President Trump, who said he should be concentrating on problems in his home district in Baltimore, which he called a disgusting rat and rodent infested mess. The attack on the area, which has a majority black population, was labelled racist by many Democrats. But reacting to his death from long-standing health difficulties, Mr. Trump offered his warmest condolences to Mr. Cummings' family and praised the congressman's strength, passion and wisdom.
Chris Buckler. As Australia's economy falters, there are calls for more school children to be taught how to be entrepreneurs. The country has got a rich history of innovation. And as jobs and careers change, there's a growing belief that young Australians need to be shown how to take risks in the world of business. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
What is an entrepreneur?
It's a long journey from the classroom to the boardroom. But in these times of monumental technological change, Australian students are being taught to seize their opportunities. Zara Lassie is a tutor with 56 Creations, a company that helps to unlock the entrepreneurial spirit of school children.
They're lucky they're growing up in this age where they've started from a place that was unpredictable and it's constantly about growth with technology. So coming from that starting point, it's almost as though they're used to it from the moment that they're born. That unpredictability is almost what fuels a lot of students. Because that unpredictability is not seen as so much a scary thing, it's seen as opportunity. It's seen as a chance for me to go, hey, I can change this, or hey, I can do what I would like.
Billy Fedden is 11, and for her, the seeds of being her own boss have now been sown.
I wouldn't have thought of becoming one myself, but it looks very cool and to be an entrepreneur and run your own business.
But classmate Gemma Young is far more apprehensive about the future.
I think it's really scary because of how technology is advancing and taking over people's jobs, but also it can make jobs easier. So, yeah, it's a bit scary.
Shopo is an online fashion store based in the centre of Sydney. It was set up by a former accountant who was born in Beijing. Jane Liu was in her early 20s when she quit her job in corporate finance and says being the boss is about constantly taking risks.
I actually didn't even tell my parents that I had quit my job. I was just pretending to go to work in a suit and just secretly started Shopo. And I was able to do that because of how easy the ecosystem is and to nurture entrepreneurship. I think you do constantly question yourself, and I definitely still have imposter syndrome. And I think you just need to let your drive and desire to succeed overcome it.
Wi-Fi, the black box flight recorder, and the electric drill are innovations Australia claims as its own. This is a land that needs invention and risk-taking. The economy here is slowing, and high living standards won't be maintained unless younger generations can turn challenges into opportunities. The signs, though, are good. Overseas, Aussie ingenuity is well regarded.
Varibor's Mashirian is a professor at the University of New South Wales Business School. He believes Australia's can-do attitude is highly regarded.
We've seen that many American companies, many European companies, for instance, they would like to come and often not only invest in Australia, but also hire Australians with Australians, if you like, mentality and culture, resilience, optimism, determination.
You get a car! You get a car! So that's from her amazing talk show that she started. And what's really cool about Oprah is that she's all about giving back.
Australia needs business leaders who are willing to think differently. The economy is depending on them, and there's no better place to start than at school, with those who are eager to learn and succeed.
Everyone give Madeline a round of applause.
Phil Mercer with that report. One of the most celebrated ballet dancers and choreographers in the world, Alicia Alonso, has died at the age of 98. She founded the Cuban Ballet Company and trained generations of dancers. Our Cuba correspondent, Will Grant, looks back at her life.
Alicia Alonso led a life dedicated to dance. From a young age, she was obsessed with the artistic depiction of beauty, making her debut in Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty. At the tender age of 16, she married and moved to New York, training at the School of American Ballet. And it was in the United States that she got her break. Her virtuoso performances, especially in Giselle, had the critics agreeing a star had been born. However, her glittering ballet career was almost over before it began. In 1941, Alonso was diagnosed with a detached retina and had to undergo surgery to correct it. Confined to bed for 3 months and only able to dance in her head, she described the ordeal as torture to the BBC years later.
Fue terrible.
It was terrible. They told me not to move my head quickly or to lower it. I was like that for 2 years. They told me I'd never dance again.
To overcome her partial blindness, she had her partners be in exactly the right spot and used the stage lights to guide her. Most audiences were none the wiser. In 1959, the Cuban Revolution took power. Unlike many of her contemporaries, Alonso returned to the island and, with Fidel Castro's blessing, set up the National Ballet Company. Alonso continued to perform until her 70s and in her later years remained Cuba's principal choreographer and artistic director. Her commitment to the arts made her a darling of the socialist revolution and probably the world's best-known ballet maestra. After years as its doyenne, prima ballerina, matriarch, the beating heart of Cuban ballet has finally come to rest.
Will Grant. Still to come in this podcast.
This new device is able to keep track of which prayer you're on and you can track your progress within the app.
Struggling to keep track at prayer time? The Vatican has an app for that. And speaking of struggling to keep track, don't forget we have a special Brexitcast podcast coming up, and we'd like you to send us your questions to unravel on it. Jackie Leonard will be putting your queries to the Brexit Dream Team, Laura Koonsberg, Adam Fleming, Katia Adler and Chris Mason. And they can be anything from what's next for Northern Ireland to can I please stop stockpiling chickpeas now? Send them to our normal address, globalnewspod@bbc.co.uk, and we'll try and shine some light onto what's really going on. Now to Hamburg in Germany, where a 93-year-old former concentration camp guard has appeared in court in what could be one of the last trials of Nazi war criminals. Bruno D., whose surname cannot be given for legal reasons, is accused of being an accessory to 5,230 murders in the final months of World War II. Stephanie Prentice has been following the trial.
When he was 17 and 18, Bruno D. manned the watchtowers of a camp in northern Poland where Jewish prisoners were killed. Many died in its gas chambers while others succumbed to hunger, sickness and exhaustion. Now in his 90s, he stands accused by prosecutors of being a cog in a systematic, malicious and cruel machine. One man, Ben Cohen, flew in from New York to attend the trial. His great-grandmother died in a gas chamber on the Stutthof site.
It's really our last chance to ever hear from someone who was a guard at a concentration camp and to understand, how does someone become a guard? What was it like to be a guard? Why did they do this? My grandmother constantly asked, why would they do this?
Prosecutors argue that as a guard, the defendant was an accessory to murder through the act of stopping inmates escaping from the camp. German newspaper Der Spiegel reports that he's also accused of using a device for surprise executions, shooting victims in the back of the neck. Despite his age and the chance of avoiding prison time, Jewish groups underline the trial's importance. Efren Zuroff is from the Simon Wiesenthal Center.
When you look at him and think of a young man at the height of his physical powers, who devoted all his energies to mass murdering innocent civilians. If I have to choose between a trial and no punishment, and no trial and no punishment, I think it's obvious what the choice is.
During pre-trial questioning, the accused said he ended up in the SS Totenkopfsturmbahn, meaning Death's Head Battalion that ran the camp, only because of a heart condition that prevented him being sent to the front. He reportedly confirmed he knew of the camp's gas chambers and admitted seeing emaciated figures, people who had suffered, but said he now regrets what happened there.
Stephanie Prentice. As Canadians get ready for Monday's federal elections, the chances of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's party winning a second term in office remains in doubt. The Liberal leader has faced personal and political scandals this year, including corruption allegations and photos emerging of him wearing black face paints. From Toronto, the BBC's Jessica Murphy reports on the contenders for Canada's top job.
In 4 short years, we've made a lot of progress, but the truth is, my friends, we're just getting started.
The Justin Trudeau running in 2019 is different, because this time he's running on a record. His Liberal government has raked up some accomplishments. It resettled thousands of Syrian refugees, legalized recreational cannabis, and renegotiated the North American Free Trade Agreement. But those achievements have been overshadowed by political crises and scandals.
Tonight, a denial from the top. The Prime Minister's answer to blistering claims of political interference in a criminal case.
One of the most damaging was the SNC-Lavalin affair, where a federal watchdog ruled he violated ethics laws. Then, early in the campaign, this news broke.
A photo surfaced today that even he described as racist.
The revelation that on at least 3 occasions, the latest incident in 2001, Trudeau wore blackface.
This is something that I deeply, deeply regret, and I never should have done it.
The revelations didn't permanently shake his poll numbers, and not all voters were fazed.
Honestly, I think it's a non-issue. I really think that in 2001, the sensibilities were different. People didn't have this on their radar.
Some people take a little extra time to grow up. So I think it's many years back. And if he has changed, then it's good.
I was very disappointed. And at the same time, I recognized that many of us, especially white people, we have to take a hard look at the things that we've done in our past that have been racist. And I'm sure Justin's not the only one.
But these scandals have made for a closer race than Trudeau perhaps intended. The Liberals have been locked neck and neck with the Conservatives, led by Andrew Scheer, a former Speaker of the House of Commons.
Mr. Trudeau, you are a phony and you are a fraud and you do not deserve to govern this country.
The Conservative leader says in his words that Trudeau is not as advertised.
The fact of the matter is there is a clear contrast in this election. Justin Trudeau's endless deficits and tax hikes to pay for it, or a Conservative plan that will leave more money in your pocket.
Scheer's campaign focuses on making life more affordable for Canadians. But he's also faced scrutiny over how a Conservative government would handle social issues like abortion.
I am personally pro-life, but I've also made the commitment that as leader of this party, it is my responsibility to ensure that we do not reopen this debate.
Scheer isn't Trudeau's only competitor. 2 other leaders have been making waves.
I'm different from the others. Like you, I know about facing obstacles.
There's New Democrat Jagmeet Singh, the first person of color to lead a major federal party in Canada. Singh came into the election as an underdog, but has outperformed expectations, holding strong at 3rd in the polls.
I'm Jagmeet Singh, and I'm in it for you.
The left-wing party's pitch to voters is that the choice isn't just between the 2 frontrunners.
Whether it's Liberal or Conservative governments, they haven't had the courage to stand up and fight for people.
Then there's the Bloc Québécois.
Battre Justin Trudeau.
a federal party focused on Quebec's sovereignty, which only runs candidates in that province.
I want to fight for Quebecers and Quebecers only. If we agree with the Canadian government, then let it be. If we don't agree, we're going to fight.
Under new leadership, Yves-François Blanchet, Quebec voters are taking another look at a party they had relegated to the sidelines in the last two elections. The rise of these parties during the campaign's final push makes a minority government scenario a real possibility. It comes just 4 short years after Trudeau swept into power with a historic majority win, leaving Monday's outcome increasingly unclear.
Jessica Murphy. We're going to go to Africa now because medical staff at a prison in the Democratic Republic of Congo have gone on strike after 45 inmates died in less than a year. The BBC's Africa editor, Will Ross, has the details.
Officials say that the prison itself is in a dire situation. It was designed to hold around 350 people, but it's holding five times that number now. There have been complaints from the people working in the prison, specifically the medical staff who were there in the prison, saying that the conditions are so bad and there's so much malnutrition and lack of food and medicine that they're literally having to watch the inmates die in that prison.
It must be appalling for even hardened prison guards to be that appalled by what's going on. Has there been a government response?
Not an official government response, but they are admitting that there is a major problem there. We've also heard from the Catholic chaplain at the prison who said that part of the problem is the International Red Cross Committee used to give medicine to the prison. It then stopped. And according to the chaplain, the government couldn't provide, and then some of the prisoners started dying from lack of medicine and food. And we also hear that some of the inmates are taken to the regional referral hospital after falling extremely sick due to the lack of food, but they often get to the hospital when it's too late. And even at that regional hospital in Bukavu, there are sometimes not enough drugs to treat them. So this is a problem that really goes to the heart of the system, not just the prison system, but also the health system.
There are problems in prisons across the country. We often hear about prison breaks in the Democratic Republic of Congo, right?
True. We often hear about prison breaks, and I think this also points to the appalling conditions inside the prisons. And even earlier this year, the BBC visited a prison south of the capital, Kinshasa, about 200 kilometres south, and there they discovered that dozens of prisoners had also died, mainly due to malnutrition, over a period of several months. So this is not an isolated case of one prison where everything's gone wrong. We've had reports of the dreadful conditions inside the prisons that have actually led to the inmates dying from basically lack of food and care.
That was our Africa editor, Will Ross, talking to Audrey Brown. Now, is a new smart bracelet the way to get more young people praying? Well, the Vatican certainly thinks so. It's launched a wearable e-rosary to replace traditional prayer beads. The $100 gadget is activated by making the sign of the cross. More from our reporter, Claire Fox.
This app is obviously paired to actual physical beads, but they're slightly special. They pair to your phone through Bluetooth, so they've got some kind of electronic device within them that allows the app to track your progress. So obviously with physical beads, you usually just hold them yourself. You have to keep track on which bead you're on. You might touch a different one. You might forget which number you're on. Prayer number 8, prayer number 9. This new device is able to keep track of which prayer you're on, and you can track your progress within the app because of how it's activated between the new physical beads that you have, these new electronic beads connected to this brand new app.
So to a certain extent, it's tapping into a need, so it's doing that. Is it going to be popular, do you think?
The Catholic Church does have a history of trying to get those tech-savvy youngsters in, and they're hoping it's going to help these young people learn how to pray with the rosary. They're hoping it's a problem that needs to be fixed, and this is their answer to it.
And in the past, though, the Catholic Church has used technical innovations to try to bring in more young people as well.
Yes, they have. This isn't the first time they've tried this. So in 2018, they actually tried to mimic the success of the incredibly popular Pokemon Go, where people use their phone apps to try and capture Pokemon in their daily lives, obviously. The Catholic Church version was slightly different. You could try and capture saint characters or characters from the Bible instead of these monster characters that you can see in Pokemon Go. It was actually quite popular and was very different.
That was Claire Fox speaking to me. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.
I'm Alicia Burke, host of That Made All the Difference, a new podcast from Bank of America. Join me as I talk to Arianna Huffington about the wake-up call that inspired her to change her life and help others. Find That Made All the Difference anywhere you get your podcasts.